Hey, Angie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ursula. Thanks. Thank you. How are you today?
You know what? We're doing well for a Tuesday, I got to tell you. But we have so much to ask you. So we always look forward to this time in the week when we can ask you all our COVID questions. So the latest being that our state just reported more than 1,000 new cases in one day, which, as you know, is the most since the pandemic began. And then we're also seeing all these huge spikes all around the country, but no big spikes in the number of deaths. Why is that happening?
So there's a lag between the time that somebody gets diagnosed and the time that somebody gets sick and the time that somebody goes to the hospital and the time that somebody dies. So right now in the South, you know, we're seeing these case numbers increase. And a lot of people have said, well, why aren't we seeing the same number of deaths that we saw during the New York pandemic? And a lot of it probably is due to this lag time, because we are starting to see other alarming indicators going up that suggest that we will see increased deaths going forward, such as ICU bed usage. There's another issue that can also influence this and can actually increase that lag time, and that's something that epidemiologists call lead bias. And this means that basically, since we have more testing, we are testing people earlier. We're not necessarily only testing people who are symptomatic. We are catching these cases earlier, so it actually takes a longer period of time for those people to get sick, go to the hospital, and for some of them to eventually die.
I was hoping that we would also hear that because we're learning more about the virus and how to treat it, that more people are actually surviving, even if they have some of these worst-case scenarios.
I mean, I definitely think that's a possibility, and I hope that it is. We do have a few tools that are not great, and we still need better, but they can help. For example, remdesivir has been shown to decrease hospital stay time, and dexamethasone, which is a steroid, has been shown to be helpful in some of the most severely ill patients. So now that we know how to apply some of those different treatments, it is possible that over time we might see the death rate go down overall, because we are managing these patients more effectively.
Dr. Rasmussen, I text you on your off day over the weekend, but you're used to that by now, and I apologize.
I don't mind, G. Not at all.
I tried to ask you a question, and for the first time ever, when you answered me, I just didn't understand. So can you try to do the best? Help me understand. Right now, there's hundreds of experts who say the coronavirus is airborne. Is that for real? What's meant by that?
So this is a really confusing problem that public health people, myself included, have had in communicating this to the public. So when we're talking about airborne, usually what people are referring to are small particle droplet nuclei, which are basically the very tiny parts of the inside of these larger respiratory droplets that we're producing. And those small particle aerosols can remain in the air for long periods of time. It can travel through HVAC systems. People are really worried about that. That's what we are talking about when we talk about aerosol or airborne transmission. But in reality, respiratory droplets, which are the primary drivers, they're the same thing. They're just larger droplets. So they have different properties. They can't stay in the air as long. They fall to the ground if they're very large because of gravity. They can be moved around by the wind and so forth, but they are airborne for periods of time. And people are inhaling those respiratory droplets and getting infected. So in that sense, it already is airborne. We already know that it's airborne because it's being transmitted by these airborne respiratory droplets. So this is really a conversation about different particle sizes, which most people don't really spend much time thinking about, I suspect, and sort of their aerodynamic properties and how much virus you could get exposed to in them. What we still think is that some of these larger particles, as well as the sort of middle-sized particles that are smaller than the big ones that you produce when you're coughing, but larger than these tiny little ones that can float through air conditioning vents, those are probably what are transmitting the virus. And it's just really hard to talk about it when you sort of have this binary system. In reality, it's a spectrum of different droplet sizes. Did that make sense?
I mean, yeah. Did I understand it? Nah, that's probably not.
Well, can I just do a follow-up to that question, though?
Yeah.
Just real quick, G.
Uh-huh.
So if it, in fact, is airborne, what does that mean for you and I in terms of what we need to do to even better protect ourselves?
So that's a great question. And I think that's where really a lot of this confusion is coming from. Do we need to be worried about these tiny little particles that could be floating through air conditioning vents? Probably not that much, because the epidemiological evidence suggests that most transmission is occurring within enclosed spaces. So, yes, it's being transmitted by these airborne droplets, but they're not actually circulating throughout your entire building. It's not very likely that any of the case clusters that we've seen were caused by these types of particles, these supposedly airborne particles. However, they are being caused by these airborne particles in the sense that they're being caused by the larger droplets. So for that, we need to take the same precautions that we've been taking. Physical distancing, try to be outside, avoid crowds, wear a mask to reduce the number of droplets that you're putting out into the environment to begin with, and practice good hand hygiene so that any droplets that get on your hands, you won't expose your face to.
Dr. Rasmussen, usually I always ask for good news, but right now I need you to shoot it to us straight. What keeps you up at night right now? What's your biggest concern?
My biggest concern really is with the leadership in this country. Over the weekend, I was very, very concerned when President Trump essentially told us that we need to start getting used to this, and that this is going to be something that we just have to accept. Because I don't believe that we have to accept this. We should not be accepting the death of 130,000 Americans. There's no way that we should accept that. It's preventable. And if we are going to have a unified message, a unified public health effort to prevent transmission, to reduce transmission in our communities, as we did back in April, then we could actually save a lot of these lives. These are preventable deaths. So I think what worries me is that if the messaging coming from the top is that we should all just give up and some of us are going to die, I really worry that people are going to actually follow that advice. For me, I don't think I could ever become numb to the deaths of 130,000 Americans, especially when many of them could have been prevented.
Doctor, I want to ask you about this new study. So every time a new study comes out, I'm always looking for any kind of bit of good news, but this wasn't one of them, which this is one from Spain, which says that herd immunity cannot be achieved without devastating effects. And basically only a small percentage of people who've had COVID may be immune again, or maybe for a shorter period of time. I mean, what is that all about?
Yeah, so there's kind of two things in there. And one is actually, in my view, sort of good news. The idea that we would get herd immunity, which we usually refer to as a population as widely vaccinated, that we would get that through natural infection is really dangerous. Because even if this virus has a 1% infection fatality rate or case fatality rate, at population scale, that's millions of people who will die. So I'm glad that we're not embarking on a course. There's not evidence to suggest that such a course would be a wise public health strategy, because I think it would again be very dangerous and detrimental. The other issue, the one about how long protective immunity lasts, is a much trickier one. So those studies called sero surveys look at how many people in the population have had it. We think that, judging by the sero survey data that we've seen, not just from Spain, but from all over the country, including even in New York, the majority of people have not actually been infected with COVID yet, which is bad, because it means that most of us are still susceptible to it. However, not having antibodies after a couple of months doesn't necessarily mean that you are not protected against the virus.
Ah.
There are other types of immunity. There are T cells in addition to B cells, which produce antibodies, that can mediate immunity and allow for protection. And in addition, even if you don't have detectable antibodies in your blood, you still have the B cells that made the antibodies circulating around in your system. So if you're exposed to the virus again, those cells can become activated and start producing more antibodies. We just don't know enough about how any of that works to make any firm conclusions about what antibodies mean in terms of long-term immune protection.
Dr. Rasmussen, one of the things that's going to possibly be talked about in the future, as kids are trying to go back to school, people are trying to go back to work and try to do the right thing to know if they in fact have COVID-19. What about the possibilities of at-home testing? What do you think about that going forward?
I think that could be potentially a real game changer. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the keys to successfully living with this pandemic in a way that minimizes deaths and hospitalizations and community transmission is to make sure that we're testing people often, including when they're asymptomatic, and routinely if they are going out into the public, such as going to school. So if we had at-home tests that were non-invasive, that people could take the samples themselves, get a quick answer, that would really be very powerful in terms of informing people what kind of public health decisions they should make. You know, somebody tests positive at home, hopefully they're not going to go to school that day. And hopefully they're going to call up the health department, and then they'll, you know, tell them who they've been in contact with so that they can contact trace and test those other people. That is really the key to controlling any kind of epidemic, including this one. So I hope that we do have some at-home tests that are sensitive and specific and reliable that people can have access to. It's really important as well that those tests, when they're available, are affordable for everybody, or that they're provided for free, even better.
I just want to make sure this is the right thing. So hypothetically, let's say I have an at-home test, or my son has an at-home test, and he tests on a Monday. So that means he's out of school for the next 2 weeks. Is that right?
Yes. If he tested positive, then yes, he should be out of school for the next 2 weeks, and you should call his doctor to make sure that, you know, he's going to be treated early, and his condition will be monitored. Wow. But yes, that is correct. If he tested positive, then he should be quarantined for 2 weeks after symptoms subside.
But again, knowing that this could change day to day, if he were to test negative, you would have to basically test your kid daily, right?
Not necessarily daily, but probably routine testing would involve testing at least a couple different times a week. And this is where another strategy that has been proposed called pooled testing comes in. This is where you would gather samples from the community and test them all together. Uh-huh. So you only have to run one test. And then if that test comes up positive, you go back and test each of those people individually. That's one way to save on tests. If such an approach could be used in addition to at-home testing, that would just overall increase our testing capacity and really help with this problem.
Now, I want to ask you, we've had a lot of questions about a vaccine, and just this morning there's a new headline that says the Trump administration is going to be paying the vaccine maker Novavax $1.6 billion to develop 100 million doses of a vaccine for coronavirus by early 2021. Your thoughts, because I know this is part of this whole warp speed vaccine effort.
Well, yeah. And, you know, my thoughts are that I hope that there is a vaccine available for mass production and mass distribution in early 2021. So I certainly hope that that works out. But of course, just like with any vaccine, you can't just only throw money at the problem. That's an important part. We definitely need to have the manufacturing capabilities to scale up a vaccine very quickly if we want to get it out to everybody. But the reality is we also need to make sure that any vaccine is safe and effective. And those clinical trials are starting now in terms of the phase 3 work for several of the vaccine candidates, many of which have also received money through Operation Warp Speed, significant amounts of money. So I think it's important to have the manufacturing infrastructure in place so that when we have a vaccine that we know works, we can get going right away with manufacturing that. But, you know, I'm still holding my breath as to whether we're going to see that vaccine actually be available in early 2021.
I just feel like so much of our life is on hold. Like, I think so many of us are waiting for that vaccine to feel safer.
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly am. You know, I think that we still, and especially with community transmission at the levels that it's at in the U.S., and as you pointed out earlier in this segment, you know, cases are going up here in Washington, too. We're going to be living under non-normal conditions for quite some time until we can get that vaccine available. And even then, you know, a vaccine is not going to be available for every single person immediately. So, you know, there's going to be a whole other set of questions and issues I'm sure we're going to have when that happens to try to figure out who needs to get the vaccine first. And there's also the issue of people not wanting to take the vaccine because of being very skeptical about it. So, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint, as many people have said about this pandemic. And it sucks, frankly, for all of us to be living through it. But, you know, this is something we are going to have to get used to for the long haul.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rasmussen. Tell Taz hello.
I will. Always a pleasure.